This is Vermont Edition. I'm Steve Zandin for Jane Lindholm. Racial bias in policing has been one of the most troubling and high-profile issues facing the nation in recent years. And while the examples are not as tragic or headline-making in Vermont as they are elsewhere, the discussion of bias in policing has been ongoing here as well. The State Police Fair and Impartial Policing Committee, which includes law enforcement representatives, racial justice advocates, and other community members, has been talking about data made public last year that shows racial disparities in state police traffic stops. The committee's been considering how changes in recruitment, training, and monitoring might address the disparities. The legislature has mandated that local law enforcement agencies also produce traffic stop data, but in most cases, it hasn't been made public yet. But now a new report released today has gathered together information from 29 local police and sheriff's departments to give us a racial breakdown of traffic stops. Like the state police data, it shows a disproportionate number of African-American and Hispanic drivers are stopped compared to white and Asian drivers. You'll find a link to the report on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Today on Vermont Edition, we'll talk about the data, what it means, and invite your calls and emails. If you have questions about how police departments collect traffic stop information, how it's used, and what conclusions might be reached from it, call us at 1-800-639-2211 or email vermontedition@vpr.net. Joining me for the first segment of our discussion to talk about the report is one of its lead authors, Stephanie Seguino, who's professor of economics at the University of Vermont. She's done extensive research on racial disparities in policing. Stephanie, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So maybe people need to understand that when we talk about traffic stop data, we're not just talking about race and gender of people who are pulled over, basically who's pulled over. There is added information that has to do with who's ticketed, who's searched, and who's arrested. That's information you look at as well. So explain why it's all important.
Sure. Often when you speak to the police, they will tell you that they don't know the race of the driver before the driver is stopped. Once the driver is stopped, however, the police officer is in a position to form a perception about the driver's race. Also, we don't have great data on who the driving population is. It isn't as accurate as we might like it to be. So really what I tend to focus on is where the post-stop outcomes. How does the officer respond once they have formed a perception of the race of the driver? Are the probabilities of being arrested, of being searched, of being ticketed different based on the race or ethnicity of the driver?
I, in the introduction, just mentioned that, like state police data, this is showing a disparity when it comes to African-American and Hispanic drivers. But dig a little deeper into it for us and explain what the takeaways from the report are.
Sure. I'll just give you a few of the key numbers because the disparities are significant. If at the state level, we find that black drivers are twice as likely to be arrested as a white driver subsequent to a stop. We can't say too much about Hispanic drivers because we don't yet have enough data to say anything with statistical reliability. And we also find that black drivers are four times as likely to be searched as white drivers. Hispanic drivers are almost three times as likely to be searched as white drivers, and they are less likely to be found with contraband once they are searched. Those are probably, for me, those are the key indicators of racial disparities. And as I said, the gaps are very large. This is at the state level, and for the agencies that we have enough data, we find the same pattern as well.
How did you choose which agencies to collect data from? Because you didn't get it from all of the local police police agencies.
First of all, we wanted to choose the largest police agencies in Vermont so that we had a broad coverage of the state. We wanted to include as many agencies as could share data with us. We had a dozen or so agencies that we communicated with and whose data we couldn't use, either because it was in paper form or because there were key variables, indicators that were missing from the data. And in some cases, it was a long process of trying to extract, for the agencies of trying to extract the data, and we simply couldn't get it in time to use. But our data do have broad coverage. So, for example, of the local police agencies, the municipal agencies, our data cover 78% of the Vermont population policed by those agencies.
So if I think what you're saying is that although the data didn't include every agency, it included the larger ones, and you're suggesting that even if you were able to get good data from all of the local law enforcement agencies, it probably wouldn't significantly change what you found?
Right. One can only, make a guess about that, right? You'd have to see the data. But my sense of it is the patterns are so uniform across the state in terms of the fact that there are racial disparities. I think it would just be a question of degree as to whether disparities would be larger or smaller. But my sense is that the evidence of racial disparities is not going to change even with the full data set.
Are you able to compare one local law enforcement agency to another, or in some cases is the data just too small to make to draw any conclusions or make any comparisons?
At the back of our study, we have reports on every agency. So we have the statewide data, but we have by agency and county. We definitely can make comparisons between agencies, especially those that have a large enough data set. And so, for example, several agencies that we got data from have been collecting data for several years. They started collecting data voluntarily before the new legislation that required it. So, for example, Rutland, Winooski, UVM, Vermont State Police in Burlington and South Burlington have several years of data. And for those agencies, we can actually make comparisons that are based on statistical tests that improve, sort of the reliability mm-hmm. of the data.
And just so we understand more clearly, you reached the conclusion that there is a, to use your word, significant disparity. Based on the number of traffic stops involving African Americans and Hispanics in comparison to their proportion of the population or the driving population?
We have both estimates. We have estimates of the driving population and we have estimates of the U.S. Census data. And we use both of those for our comparisons. But I do want to make clear that that's only relevant for the stop rates. All of our post-stop outcomes do not rely on estimates of the driving population. And so those we are very confident in terms of the accuracy, at least insofar as the quality of the data is good. Our estimates we are very confident in those. The estimates of the driving population are a challenge still because we use data from the Department of Motor Vehicles, which has data on the race of drivers in not-at-fault accidents. And unfortunately, for the last 6 years of data that we have, 30% of those incident reports, the accident reports, are missing the race of the driver. So we can only do, quality analysis insofar as the quality of the data is good. And we're hoping that shedding a light on this will improve the missing data in that category.
Right. And given what you just said in your earlier comment that some of the law enforcement agencies' collection of data was incomplete or there were key elements missing, you have faith in the findings of this report?
Yes. I want to just say once again that the quality of the report depends upon the quality of the data. I've looked at data for long enough, and I've looked at Vermont data for long enough, and noticed that these disparities are so wide that even with improvement in the quality of the data, my guess is that these disparities aren't going to disappear. They may be smaller. They may be larger than what we observe right now. But having worked with data for a very long period of time, the sort of problems with some of these data and sort of missing variables and so forth is not deeply concerning to me. It doesn't make me feel that our results are not sound.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that is underscored in the report is the fact that for many law enforcement agencies, the collection of this data has only recently begun, right? For many, you only have data for 2015.
Right.
And so we don't really – that's going to be a benchmark, essentially, for future comparisons.
I think that's the best way to look at this data set is this is a benchmark going forward. It isn't a picture of who we are, but it tells us it gives us an opportunity to measure how well are we doing going forward in terms of reducing racial disparities.
This word disparity is different from calling it bias.
Mm-hmm.
I think you would agree.
Yes, absolutely.
Is there some other explanation other than bias?
There may very well be. So, for example, one of the things that we hear from police themselves is that they are more likely to stop a vehicle that's old or broken down and so forth. They tend to be more suspicious of those drivers. And insofar as the people of color tend to be have higher poverty rates, there might be that what's happening here is poverty profiling. And so that's a possible explanation. The point I think that is important here is that these data are really a tool for law enforcement agencies to internally look at their practices and to ensure that they are engaging in fair and unbiased policing. This is a tool to help them do that. What we know is that racial disparities and racial discrimination exist in all of our institutions in the United States, not just in Vermont, in employment, in the medical field, in schools, and so forth. So the results should not be surprising to anybody. I think the real issue here is that Vermont has taken on the challenge of being self-aware and of trying to improve policing so that it fairly treats and supports all of the communities in our state.
Here's a question that a listener asked Stephanie Seguino. Jeff wants to know, was the state of vehicle registration looked into as a confounding variable? Jeff writes, I imagine racial patterns become less prominent when state of registration is controlled for.
That's a great question. That was not required by the legislation. Some agencies do have that data. And a couple of years ago, when I looked at South Burlington's data, they had the state of the vehicle registration of the driver, and there were no differences in terms of the post-op outcomes and so forth between in-state and out-of-state vehicles. It's certainly useful to do that, and I think we've made some recommendations about additional data that we believe would be useful for law enforcement agencies to collect, and that would be one of the categories.
Is racial bias a factor in policing in Vermont, or is racial disparity something we should look into more closely to see what role bias plays? That's one of the questions that comes from a new report called Driving While Black and Brown in Vermont. We're talking to one of the report's key authors, EVM economics professor Stephanie Seguino. We'd like to hear from you as well at 1-800-639-2211 or post your comments at the Vermont Edition Facebook page. In a moment, we'll talk, we'll be joined, that is, by the Burlington Police Chief, Brandon Del Pozo. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Steve Zend in for Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Authors of a new report that collects and analyzes data from 29 law enforcement agencies in Vermont say there's evidence based on population figures that black and Hispanic drivers in Vermont are treated differently by police, stopped more, cited more, and searched more than white and Asian drivers. Does this discrepancy show an implicit racial bias in policing? How should we address it? And what other factors might be involved? Those are the questions we're asking today and asking you to chime in at 1-800-639-2211. We've been talking with Stephanie Seguino. She's still with us. She's the lead author of the report called Driving While Black and Brown in Vermont. And we're also joined now by Burlington Police Chief Brandon Del Pozo. Chief, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I know you. I think you were at the press conference this morning. I'm sure you're familiar somewhat with the report. Anything in it that you question or have concerns about?
No, I think Professor Seguino and I have been working on issues such as these, as well as, you know, the Vermont State Police and other law enforcement and policing officials. We've been all working together collaboratively on this for, you know, at least a year or two now. And so it's not questioning so much. I think we've acknowledged that it would be great to have a better understanding of the driving population. But then again, Professor Seguino's right when she says once you have somebody stopped, it doesn't make any difference what the driving population was. It's how they're treated that you know, is something that they're measuring. So, again, driving population, also it would be good to have a sense with our police making sure that they're coding things properly, not omitting the race of a driver, not omitting outcomes. You look sometimes up to 5 to 10% of the time, there's a blank box. And so I think there's data quality issues that police across the state need to reckon with. But no, their findings are illuminating.
You know, Burlington's a big police department, and maybe collecting this data isn't so much a challenge for you as it is for some of the smaller police departments. Stephanie Seguino, did you see any sort of pattern there that it was a more difficult enterprise for smaller police departments?
My conversations with chiefs from those smaller departments really illuminated that for me. In fact, in one agency, it was the police chief himself who had to extract the data and send it to me because he didn't have administrative assistance to do that. And so for some agencies, the very small ones, it took a long time to get the data from them because this was the first time through. I do think in the future, as they have more practice doing this, it'll become an easier enterprise. But it is a struggle for the small agencies.
And Chief Del Pozo, to get to this question of, you know, as Stephanie Seguino has said, the report shows a significant disparity in traffic stops. But we stop short of calling that racial bias. What's your take? Does this show that there's bias in policing?
Yeah, I really have to say I appreciate Professor Seguino making, you know, the careful distinctions you hope a scholar makes when she does research like this. And, you know, I'll give you two examples that I think show where we fall on this. One is so we do have an analyst at the Burlington Police Department, Eric Fowler. He's a doctoral student in criminal justice, trained in econometric methods. And he took the data, and because we have the luxury of doing this, we went a few steps further, did some regression analyses. And we found in our case that whether a person is driving with a suspended license or no license really varies by race. And unfortunately, black drivers are driving with a suspended license 12% of the time, white drivers 4% of the time. And when you factor that in and control for it, because cops do give tickets, not warnings, for suspended licenses, it eliminates a lot of the disparity between between tickets and warnings. I mean, a whole other can of worms gets opened up. You know, State Attorney General T.J. Donovan wonders, you know, is it fair the way we adjudicate suspended licenses? I mean, how Stephanie talked about poverty, your ability to pay a ticket to navigate the court system. But that was illuminating for us. On the other hand, so I felt comfortable with warnings versus tickets. At least we had an understanding. Searches last year were a difficult topic for us. We were searching black motorists disproportionately. And then as I reminded my officers, you know, in person, candidly, and not finding contraband. So that was a much harder nut to crack, and I think we really needed to make changes in that regard.
Well, it's interesting because Burlington Police Department is one of those departments that's paid a lot of attention to this for some years now. And yet, as you say, you're still seeing problems. Does that point to it being something that's more intractable than maybe you thought initially?
I think that it's hard. So one of the problems, even for Burlington, we're wrestling with one of the issues of small numbers. When the numbers are small, it's hard to make programmatic changes. And I'll just illustrate, you know, our searches of motorists of color, of black motorists, are typically between 1 and 2 dozen a year. So between 1 and 2 a month. When we're talking about bringing a number like 24 down to 15 or 12 or 10, it's hard programmatically to do that. It's really, you know, you're having a transaction that's happening at the roadside once or twice a month that's resulting in a stop. Mm-hmm. It really needs to be in the cop's DNA to be introspective about this and understand his or her motivations for doing it. New York City found that it was conducting 80% of its driving while intoxicated checkpoints in communities of color, and that was producing a disproportionate impact. And it was able to say, as a matter of programmatic reform, we're not going to conduct 80% of our checkpoints in communities of color. These were on the order of hundreds of checkpoints a year. It's hard in a state this size to really affect change unless you get to the root cause of it. And that's hard.
You know, that's a good point about the small sample size. And Stephanie Seguino, we touched on this a little while ago. But, you know, we're talking about what we're calling significant disparity. But in a small police department that isn't nearly as active as a Burlington Police Department, can that disparity be accounted for just by one or two traffic stops, essentially?
We don't make assessments if there is that small a number of traffic stops of black drivers or Asian or Hispanic drivers. We really have to have a large enough sample. And we were careful to relate our findings only to those agencies that had enough enough stops, for example. Vermont State Police has had 250,000 stops in the last 5 years. That's a very large data set. And when we pool the data together for the entire state for 2015, which a lot of our analysis was based on, we had over 100,000 stops. So when we pool the data for the state, then there's really no question that we have sufficient number of stops on which to base analysis. But as Chief Del Pozo noted, of course, the conduct of law enforcement is at the agency level. And so some agencies may not have enough experience with traffic stops by race to be able to see patterns that help them to identify where the problems are. I think that's why this is important for this to be a statewide issue, because agencies can share information, they can share insights that they've learned, and they can share steps that they've taken that might be illuminating to other agencies. Even instead of having to wait for several years of data, we might really pool experience at the state level.
1-800-639-2211, our number at Vermont Edition, as we discuss this new report on racial disparities in traffic stop data collected by, in part by Stephanie Seguino, a researcher at the University of Vermont. Also joining us is Brandon Del Pozo, the police chief of Burlington. Let's take a call from Mark in Montpelier. Hi, Mark.
Hey, it's Mark Hughes. Hey, Brandon. Hey, Stephanie.
Hey,
Stephanie, great work. I just saw both of you at the press conference, and I just wanted to just add a bit of flavor to the discussion in terms of context. First of all, I just wanted to just remind all of our listeners that a lot of this, I'm sorry, I'm just getting into the state house right now. A lot of this conversation, well, this entire discussion originated with Act 134, 2012, which was Susie Wisawati's legislation, entitled Racial Disparities in the Criminal Justice System. Okay, so we're talking about a whole systemic issue. We've acknowledged since then that we all have biases informed by our past of genocide and slavery. We all have them. And law enforcement has acknowledged this as well. So I think we think it's time to do away with the discussion as to whether or not this is being motivated or that it could be informed by racial biases. Whether they're implicit or explicit is the question. We're dealing with implicit stuff because we have other apparatuses to deal with explicit bias. Data collection is a tool to measure our progress. There's 50 agencies that are missing or so here, and there's 24 who just reported for the first time. This is a benchmark, and we got to measure our progress. But we also need to understand that the policy that we signed off on, the four-hour block of instruction for all law enforcement and implicit bias, as well as the in-service training, is not even due to be completed until the end of 2018. And in addition to that, I beg your pardon, I meant to say training there. And the policy was just implemented on the 1st of July, 2016. I, myself, with Justice for All, in conjunction with members of the ACLU, and the Human Rights Commission, Peace and Justice Center, and also the folks over at Migrant Justice have surveyed all agencies in the state. And there are dozens of them who have not even responded on the status of their current policy. So there's a lot of moving parts here. We haven't even started the conversation about the additional component that would overlay all of this, would be civilian oversight of law enforcement. There's a lot of moving parts, and I think that the best context that I can come up with here is that this is a tool. We need to figure out a way to gather information more frequently. We need to be able to do so from all agencies to develop a consistent look and feel across the entire state. We need to take into consideration what's going on with all of our other moving parts, specifically those that were called out in the same legislation that called for this, and that is that of policy and training. And we need to start having some serious discussions on funding this entire effort. And I'll take the response to all of this off the air. Again, thank you very much, Stephanie, for her hard work, and Brandon, of course, you as well. I look forward to seeing some use of force data from you soon. Bye.
Thanks, yeah. Mark. Mark Hughes, we should say, leads a group called Justice for All and also a member of the State Police Fair and Impartial Policing Committee. Stephanie, I'm sorry, you were going to respond?
Just briefly, I think Mark points to, you know, this important issue that once the study has come out, there's a tendency to just lose focus on this. And yet the work that remains to be done is to continue to get the data and to ensure that we're analyzing it annually and that we're reflecting back on what is working and what's not working. And so I appreciate that it really will take community advocates to continue to keep the focus on this so that we can make progress.
Chief Del Pozzo, here's a question to you from Jacob, who asks, does the lack of diversity in a police force influence this kind of racial bias? Would Chief Del Pozzo push to diversify the force as an answer to the kind of bias and profiling seen in other areas?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. So I'd like to thank that gentleman for asking that. You know, one of the things that Mark Hughes talked about was policy and the need for adherence to policy. Another approach is programs as well, programmatic reform, how police agencies act apart from, you know, something like a 12-step declaration of our principles. And, you know, we've taken great strides to diversify the Burlington Police Department. Of course, the bar in Vermont for diversity is low, just as this being a, you know, predominantly white state. But we've gone from we just hired, for example, we'll be hiring an Ecuadorian-American cop. We just hired a Chinese-American cop. We just hired an African-American cop. We've gone from just simply processing applications, which is something a lot of police departments do, to actively recruiting the type of force that we envision would be right for Burlington, which is one that's apace with Burlington's diversification. However, I mean, I have to say, you know, we've had African American cops who have done a lot of car stops, and when we go down into the data, we find that they are behaving in the same way as their white counterparts in the demographics of who they're stopping. So at one level, diversity is very important because it imparts a social conscience into the organization. It teaches officers cultural competency. It helps the public identify and trust with their police. But there's also systemic things about policing that mean – I mean, for example, if cops are always going to give tickets to someone with a suspended license, whether you're a black cop or a white cop, you're still issuing that ticket. So just briefly to address what Mark was saying, we have to use this tool that Professor Seguino has given us to really focus our actions. And so our opinion here in Burlington is we're focusing on the searches. The searches are something that we need to address and something that's of concern.
I think, as you touched on, Chief Del Pozzo, recruitment is part of it, and recruitment of minorities may well be part of it. But there's also there are also questions about how police screen recruits to try to identify bias in that recruit. In other words, to sort of take preventative steps so that we're not seeing if bias, to the extent that bias is reflected in the work Stephanie has done, we're not seeing it as much.
Yeah, I mean, one of the tricks about what we just said, and again, Mark Hughes makes a useful distinction. There's explicit and implicit bias, and any indication of explicit bias is a means for automatic disqualification from policing. What we're wrestling with is in many cases implicit bias that people can't even articulate when you press them on it, right? And so that's why we need the training, but it's also why we need oversight, supervision, and we need to understand exactly where it's functioning. I mean, if it's suspended licenses, then we need a system that makes sure that folks have access to the processes that adjudicate their summonses fairly, regardless of race. But if it's us as cops making a decision to search or not search at the roadside, that's where we have the power. We need to understand what we're doing when we make those decisions.
As Stephanie Seguino, I know you've done this research, but you've also been part of the discussions. You're a member of the State Police Fair and Impartial Policing Committee. What's your sense of the process that's now in place for recruiting and screening candidates for, let's say, state police, and also the training that's directed at the issue of bias that takes place?
So I want to just say that I don't have a deep knowledge in this area. I've had some conversations and exposure to the Vermont Police Academy curriculum, as well as the efforts by the Vermont State Police. Chief DePozo makes the correct point that there is really a lot of effort up front at the Vermont State Police and at the Burlington Police Department to screen out people with explicit bias. Implicit bias is tough, and a one-time training isn't going to solve that issue. And I want to say again, it bears repeating over and over again, we all have this because we have been socialized this way. The media, the film industry, at many levels, this has become invisible to us, and the challenge is to make it visible. So, for example, Chief DePozo has taken the implicit association test. I believe he's working on his officers taking that. It's a good way to reveal what we're doing. I know that the Vermont State Police is having conversations with its individual barracks as well as with its officers around their stop rates as an effort to get at a greater reflection of those biases. I'm not familiar with what other agencies are doing, but I do think both of these agencies can really serve as a model for other agencies, mm-hmm. and a lot can be learned from what they are doing.
Chief DePozo, here's a comment from Keith, who says the concern should be that police are being unfairly targeted for biased policing. This leads to police not making stops and arrests for blatant crimes for fear of being targeted. Do you think that's a concern?
I think that, some police officers and agencies do feel, especially in the last year, that the profession has come under attack in a way that's shaken cops' confidence and made them, hesitant to take proactive action. But I don't think it's because of the type of analyses that Professor Seguino is doing. I mean, these are very thoughtful and careful, and that, they're not drawing premature conclusions. I think. The way I approach it with my officers is, number one, 4 hours of training is not going to take the implicit bias or racism or dispositions out of someone. So you got to pick the right folks. But also, I think the attitude, my police officers feel like they work really hard. They really do have the public interest at heart. They're alarmed at the thought that they're doing harm in doing this. And we need to find a way to say to them, listen, you are doing great work. You are serving the public. And if we could address this vulnerability in the way we do police work through a lot of different methods. I mean, T.J. Donovan at the state level has talked about license restoration in some cases. That these are helpful ways to take the to help cops feel like they're doing the very good work that they're doing without feeling like they're carrying this albatross around with them as well.
Stephanie Seguino, I know you gave this data to police departments before today. What kind of conversations have you had with the heads of those departments since then?
I had great conversations with the departments, including a few that had very elevated disparities. I learn a lot in these conversations, and I'm able to sort of explain the data to them in a way that helps them be able to use it. What I heard from all of the chiefs that I spoke to is a sincere commitment for fair policing. And as Chief DePozo said, a concern and, really severe disappointment if they are in fact doing harm. So I get a great sense that the police want to address these disparities. I think it is always shocking to get data that tell you that you're not where you want to be. Whether it's you go to the doctor and your blood pressure is elevated, or you step on the scale and you've gained 10 pounds, or or in something like this where there are these disparities that police were not aware of. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to accept that that's a normal psychological reaction initially. As chiefs have gotten comfortable with the fact that these data exist, their next question to me is, what do we do? And I sense a very sincere desire to move forward. They tell me also that many of them don't have the resources that the Vermont State Police and Burlington and some of the other larger agencies do, and they need some support in figuring out how to utilize the data better, how to improve its quality, and what steps to take next. But overall, what I sensed was a real genuine interest in the data and a willingness to use it to improve their policing.
And just briefly, Stephanie Seguino, can you put Vermont in context in terms of where we stand in collecting and using this type of data?
Vermont is, I think, is now moving to the forefront. There are 31 states that collect race data in traffic policing, but very few states actually both collect it comprehensively and make it publicly available. Our neighboring states, for example, don't have, such as Maine and New Hampshire, don't have such extensive collection requirements, or they don't make it publicly available. So I think we need a few more categories of data. And I think if we do this analysis every year, we're really going to be in the forefront of a number of states in the country.
UVM professor and researcher Stephanie Seguino and Burlington Police Chief Brandon Del Pozo, thank you both for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The report released today is called Driving While Black and Brown in Vermont. There's a lot of data there, including the traffic stop data for individual police departments. The full report is linked from the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Now, coming up, tiny space satellites orbiting the Earth need a little help to navigate the heavens. We'll learn about a South Burlington tech startup that's making that possible. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Steve Zind, in for Jane Lindholm today. Cape Canaveral in Florida, Mission Control in Texas, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California. Will we someday be able to add Vermont to the list of states with a big stake in space and space exploration? Well, that remains to be seen, but a startup in South Burlington wants to get us on the map and wants to get in on the ground floor of a coming revolution in small satellites. Greenscale Technologies is developing tiny propulsion systems for these small satellites, and here to talk about it is Ryan McDevitt, the company's co-founder and lead research and design engineer. Ryan, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, tell us, a lot of people don't know about these tiny satellites, so describe them for us.
Sure. So these satellites, the ones that we're most focused on are called CubeSats, and they're about, they're about 4-inch cubes that weigh under 10 pounds. And they can be assembled kind of like Legos into different shapes, but that's the rough size.
So how do they get up there to begin with?
Yeah, they piggyback rides. So a big satellite might be going up, or we might be taking supplies back to the space station, for example. And these will ride up on those launches, and sometimes as many as dozens of them are launched simultaneously. So they'll shoot out of whatever craft is carrying them up.
Well, what can you do with something that small?
Yeah, they can do a lot of the same functions that a larger satellite can do, such as imaging, telecommunications. But the most interesting work is when you use many of them, you can do multi-point sampling, so like climate science, where we're studying lots of different points on the globe simultaneously. That's something you can't do with a larger satellite.
Yeah, and the other thing is you don't need to be NASA, right, to put these I know Vermont Technical College, for example, launched a CubeSat a while back.
That's exactly right. I mean, that's a big benefit that we're starting to see. This all came out of academia, but it's starting to spill over into the commercial sector where a smaller company can afford to put one of these up and use them to augment their business.
And it's when they're up that you are involved, right? Once these satellites are launched and orbiting the Earth, then you're creating propulsion systems for them.
That's exactly right. And when they go up, they piggyback up and they get deposited in whatever orbit is convenient for the launch provider. And what we're looking to do is to make it so that they can change their orbit, go to a different location, move around, avoid obstacles, and then safely come back down when they're done.
Well, I know enough about space to know that a little fan won't cut it for propulsion up there. So what are you using for a system in a satellite that small?
Yeah, the system that we're using is based on hydrogen peroxide, which is one of the oldest chemical propellants in use. I mean, it dates way back to the very beginnings of rocketry. But what we're looking at is to do this at the very small scale, there's actually some complicating factors. And so the technologies that we're working with, it started at the University of Vermont where I got my PhD and am kind of working through that. We've been able to develop these new techniques to make it work at the small scale.
So these are, I mean, can you describe how large the propulsion system is given the fact the satellite's so small?
Right, sure. So if you think of that 4-inch cube being a satellite, I mean, our entire propulsion system is going to fit in the bottom of that. And the rocket itself, the actual nozzle, which you might be familiar with from the big, like the Apollo missions, our actual rocket is about an inch long.
And where are you then in terms of actually producing these things?
Yeah, so we are about, I mean, we're aiming for a late 2018, early 2019 launch. That's what we're building towards right now. And so we're in the process of qualification testing.
And how do you do that?
So that's all the making sure that it can survive a launch. So that's all the shock and vibration testing and making sure it can survive in the vacuum of space and you know, that all your valves and seals and all that kind of stuff survives that. So that's what we're working on right now.
And that's something you're doing right at Greenscale.
Yeah, that's something that we're doing in collaboration with the University of Vermont. We're actually working with some faculty there and students to help us with the qualification testing.
And there's a UVM satellite in the works that's going to give you a chance to test it in a sort of real world or real world, if that's the right term, environment.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, we're working with the University of Vermont. There are several teams of students there, senior design projects that are working to build out this satellite. It's going to be UVM's first CubeSat launch, and like you said, State of Vermont's second CubeSat launch. And we're working to support that all along the way in terms of the different engineering, but specifically that'll be an opportunity for us to launch this system.
So what's the market then, you know, beyond the UVM satellite? What's the potential here for these propulsion systems you're making?
Yeah, so that's really the exciting part. Right now there are about 400 of these small satellites launched every year, but market analysis kind of shows that as the cost continues to fall for them, we're expecting there to be thousands of these launched every year around the world. And every one that goes up, a system like ours has so many benefits. It makes it last longer, it makes it more functional while it's up there, and it makes it safer to operate, that we think that every satellite that launches is a potential customer for a product like what we're developing.
And you're not just developing them, you're going to manufacture them yourself there?
That's correct. I mean, that's one of the nice things about being at the scale that we are, is that we think that, I mean, we've looked around and Vermont actually has the infrastructure to support that scale. We've got the machinery and we've got the talent in state to make that happen.
So what's the timeline for the UVM satellite?
So that's the late 2018, early 2019 is what we're targeting right now.
And how many people are working at Greenscale at this point?
So we've got two full-time employees right now that are doing that. And then, like I said, we're working with all these different UVM students and faculty to help support what we're doing and we're supporting what they're doing.
Is anybody else in the country or anywhere else trying to make these propulsion systems?
Yeah, there's definitely interest in all sorts of different places. There's an MIT spinoff that's doing something similar. University of Illinois has something similar. They all have different kind of niches. You can kind of think of it as, you know, there's the high efficiency Prius version and then there's the heavy duty diesel version. So each one kind of fits into its own thing. So they're not exactly in direct competition. They're kind of a complementary spectrum of propulsion options that are being developed.
How different are the designs and how unique is yours among them?
They can be very different. Some are electric, microscale electric propulsion systems that don't use chemical propellant at all. And then some are more similar to ours. The real benefits to ours is this technique for scaling it down. It lets us more efficiently operate at the micro scale. It also lets us manufacture our product a lot less expensively. So that's going to be a big benefit when we actually bring this to market in terms of our competition, that we can have this product that's so much less expensive than what they're able to offer.
So, Ryan, did all this for you kind of evolve from, let's say, a youthful interest in space?
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. I did my undergrad, and when I was doing that, I had some interest in kind of micro-scale propulsion. I always knew I wanted to be an aerospace engineer. I grew up in South Burlington and went to school out of state. And when I came back to Vermont, I still had this interest, and I ended up at the University of Vermont working with Professor Darren Hitt, who had this grant to study micro-propulsion. And so I did that for a few years, and this kind of grew out of that.
So dream big for feel free to dream big for a moment. Where would you like all this to lead?
I mean, what we're really aiming for is, so we've got this propulsion product that we want to develop, and then ultimately we want to support the entire suite of small satellite products. So the sensors and the thermal management and the computers and all of that. We want to be able to be a full service operation for these small satellites, and we want to do it here in Vermont. It's really important to my wife and I that we support Vermont and try and keep high tech jobs here. It's something that we're really focused on and continue to be. So that's what we're trying to do, is make this happen and make it happen here.
Well, I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you very much.
It's been really interesting hearing about your endeavor, Ryan.
Excellent. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thank you. Ryan McDevitt is with co-founder, I should say, and lead researcher and design engineer at Greenscale Technologies, working on the propulsion systems for those tiny satellites. Well, that's our program for today. Coming up tomorrow, who cares about Greenland? A group of researchers at the University of Vermont does, and apparently so should we. Tomorrow, we'll learn about the studies they've been doing to understand if and when the ice on Greenland has melted. And they'll discuss what a melting Greenland ice sheet could mean to the planet now. We welcome your questions or comments on that subject at vermontedition@vpr.net, and we invite you to listen tomorrow at noon. Our program is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. The theme music composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Steve Zind. Thanks a lot for listening.